It's Wednesday, January 19, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The news out of Australia is nothing less than chilling. It has to do with a couple there that aborted twin boys because they wanted a girl. The background to this story is that they had a girl who died, and the couple now expresses the fact that they are demanding the right to have a baby daughter. And after they aborted the two baby boys, they've gone before a Victorian court, that is, a court in Australia's region of Victoria, in order to demand the right to gender select their next child by IVF. Now, currently in Australia, gender selection is not considered an ethical or legal basis for in vitro fertilization treatments. But this couple's going with the audacity to say they ought to have the right to demand a baby girl. Now, what's being lost in all this, of course, is the fact that this couple aborted two little baby boys, twin boys, because they were not the children that this couple wanted. Now, the statements coming out of the couple are absolutely frightening. The father said, after what we've been through, we think we're due for a bit of luck. Can you believe that statement? A statement made about their appeal to be able to gender select a daughter in their next IVF round of treatments. Out of luck, of course, were these two little boys who were aborted, the innocent victims of a couple who, after all, want what amounts to a designer baby. We certainly can identify with their grief having lost a daughter, but they've now compounded that grief with the guilt of having terminated the lives of their own twin sons because they simply were not the baby they wanted. And by the way, the father also said, we can't just simply go on having children. That was his rationale for aborting the twins. Now, the Australian government does not allow gender selection for IVF treatments. Look at that and say, well, what about the United States? Well, here's the even more chilling thing for those of us who are in the United States. If this couple is turned down in Australia, they can just come to the United States because we have no law whatsoever suggesting that this is illegal. America has become the wild, wild west of reproductive technologies, and we have depreciated and discounted the sanctity of human life, even as Sanctity of Human Life Sunday is before us in just a few days. We need to recognize that our discount of human life is now to the extent that we are unable to muster a cultural consensus in this country even to make illegal human cloning or gender selection abortions or gender selection IVF treatments. Now, in an interesting exchange, a fictional exchange imagined by the Australian newspaper known as The Australian, a doctor has a conversation with an individual who's demanding a designer child. The person demanding the child says, hello, doctor. As you know, I have three sons. We decided to go for a fourth child, but only on certain conditions. The obstetrician says, The individual says, yeah, you know, like that Victorian couple who had three boys and wanted a girl. So when their IVF treatment saw her become pregnant with twin boys, they aborted and started again. Now they've gone to the administration tribunal to win the right to select their child's sex via IVF. The obstetrician then says to the patient, you do realize thousands of women undergo the often painful and emotionally draining IVF procedure and never manage to conceive. Just to get a pregnancy is considered a miracle for many couples. This patient says, blah, blah, emotional blackmail. It says, bang it all on like you heading down a dangerous road when one gender starts to be more highly valued than the other. But the customer's always right. It's just a matter of whether you have the expertise to provide what I'm willing to pay for. Such as, for starters, how can you test for IQ? Unless she's smart, I'm not interested. And the obstetrician allows the patient to go on who says, also, I want my daughter to be pretty, but not too pretty. I don't want her life defined by her looks, and I want her confident but not boorish, bookish but not boring, and musical. Let's not forget musical. Well, the patient at the end says, well, it's really not about them, is it? It's all about me. By the way, is there any way to make sure she's the supporter of my favorite team? In other words, this piece of satire, very reminiscent of Jonathan Swift, gets right to the heart of the matter. This is really not about the child. It's about the parents. And those of us looking at this from a Christian worldview have to understand that what we have in this demand to be, after all, the parents of designer children, well, it's very much like what we read in the scripture where we are told that what Adam and Eve wanted to be, as tempted by the deceiver, was to be as God. We want to play God. And the horror of all of this is seen in the absolute lack of conscience of this couple and the fact that their numbers could be by the thousands, especially here in the United States, where this kind of story wouldn't even get in the news because there would be no need for legal action. This could be going on at the IVF clinic right down your street. Time magazine was out with a very interesting story on young adults. Let me just read to you the opening paragraph by Melody Melnick. She says this: "It's hard to conceive anything young people might want or value more than food, getting an extra paycheck, or even having sex. But according to the results of a recent study in the journal Personality, there's one thing prized most among college students: a boost to their self-esteem." Two consecutive studies, a total of 282 students. The researchers were at Ohio State University, and they showed that the majority of students chose praise over things like food, alcohol, sex, and sentimental rewards like seeing a close friend. They even chose accolades over cold, hard cash. Well, Brad Bushman, the lead researcher, says that this generation of young people might be, it's interesting that he says might be, addicted to self-esteem. Now, there have been many studies done in the past. Gene Twenge and Keith Campbell, for instance, in their work, The Narcissism Epidemic, pointed out that this generation of young people has been raised to believe that their own self-esteem is the greatest good for which they should aim, that it is the most precious commodity. They have been praised, indeed they have been overpraised, and they live on that praise. And when they are denied that praise, they're willing to exchange almost anything for it. You know, here Christians need to be reminded, as we remind others, that we do not find our self-esteem in terms of ourself. We find our esteem in terms of Christ. And we esteem Christ. And our self-esteem is simply in the fact that God made us as creatures of his own love. He made us in his own image. And he made us in order to redeem us from sin by the substitutionary atonement of the Lord Jesus Christ. He lavishes his love upon us. But it's not about us. It's not for the sake of our name that he did these things, but for the sake of his name. At the end of the day, if we hunger after self-esteem, the problem is we'll never have enough. It's like a virus that eats from within. It creates a hunger that is greater than any world or society or set of parents or teacher can satisfy. There's something very, very sad about this report in the Journal of Personality, but it turns out that something like this is inevitable when we start to tell people that the most important thing in their lives is self-esteem. You know, the moral quandaries we face in a modern society tell us about the institutionalized nature of sin. Here's a headline from the Wall Street Journal on Tuesday morning. Bioterror fears prompt U.S. to keep its smallpox cash. That's right. The United States and Russia are demanding the right to retain stocks of the smallpox virus. Why? Well, in case a terrorist comes up with a strain that they try to use in terms of bioterrorism. Now, frankly, by the time you read the article, you probably think this is a pretty wise move. But is it not interesting that in a fallen world, we have to keep vials filled with a deadly toxin and virus just in case someone else has one of those vials they want to throw at us? That tells us a great deal about the intractable nature of human sin and why the world is crying out for redemption. In Pakistan, we've been talking about the murder of Salam Taseer, the governor of the Punjab province, now about 2 weeks ago. Here's the really frightening thing there. Remember that he was assassinated by members of his own security squad. We now know that those security squads and much of the Pakistan police force and intelligence agency have been infiltrated by Muslim extremists. Well, here's what's even more frightening. There is a generational divide, according to the press, in terms of attorneys in Pakistan. And younger attorneys tend to support the assassin rather than the victim because they buy into the idea that Pakistan is a Muslim state and that an act which is in defense of Allah and Islam is superior to the laws of the state. Well, that's the very recipe for Islamic extremism. But in this case, and here's what's really frightening when you consider the nature of human sin, this is not something that's relegated to an impoverished fringe, to an oppressed minority. This is the creme de la creme of Pakistani society, the very elite of their young lawyers. If you're watching World Events, you're certainly looking at Haiti and Tunisia. In Tunisia, the deposing of a dictator has been followed by, well, at least at this point, it looks like another dictator. What we have to hope and pray for is that there will be something better for the Tunisians, indeed an opening for the gospel. But in Haiti, the world has been very surprised by the return of baby doc Duvalier, that is Jean-Claude Duvalier, the son of a dictator, and a dictator himself who was deposed just a matter of about 25 years ago. He has returned to Haiti, and reports as of Tuesday afternoon variously said he had and had not been arrested. One of the interesting things is that when he landed, he told Radio Caribis, "I am not here for politics. I am here for the reconstruction of Haiti." Well, Those words, spoken by one of the most brutal dictators ever in the Western Hemisphere, should send chills down the Western spine. And the reality is that if he does indeed return to power, it will be a reversion in Haiti to the very kind of dictatorship they sought to overthrow. But Haiti is another sign to us of the limitations of a democratizing project where the basic fundamentals of a society are not there in terms of the respect for law and civil liberty and social order. It'll be very interesting to see what happens here, but it's another reason to pray for the beleaguered people of Haiti. This is the 10th year anniversary of Wikipedia this week. Wikipedia broke off from the site that was known as Newpedia. It was a peer-edited encyclopedia. Jimmy Wales led the effort, and 10 years ago Wikipedia was launched. It now has, get this, more than 3.5 million articles in English. Let's face it. Along with Google and a few other websites, Wikipedia is one of those must-go places. When you hear about something and you want to know more, the first inclination or instinct of a very digitalized generation is to go to Wikipedia. Now, academics and the cultural elites may sneer at this, but let me tell you, it's a natural reflex to go there first. It is, indeed, a peer-edited encyclopedia online, and for that reason, there could be misinformation on it. But it's another sign of an open society that such a thing can be out there and articles can be criticized and edited and written and rewritten. You know, the real issue from an academic perspective is not the danger of going to Wikipedia, but the danger of being satisfied there without going to the primary sources and going to the bases, the sources and the authorities cited in these articles. But Wikipedia has changed the world. And in the main, I think it's changed the world for the better. We can now very quickly look something up and gain a basic knowledge, just a very capsulated knowledge, and then perhaps have our hunger set for more. But the 10th year anniversary is just a reminder that it hasn't always been this way. Just 10 years, now 3.5 million articles. Another interesting story comes out of Louisville, Kentucky. The Louisville Courier-Journal reported a story with the headline, get this, clubs try to block local ban on nudity. 25 adult businesses are appealing to the nation's high court. That's the U.S. Supreme Court, hoping that they'll take the case on appeal, a case that outlaws total nudity. Chris Quay, reporting for the Courier-Journal, said unless the nation's highest court intercedes, city officials say they will begin enforcing the ordinance as early as February, effectually ending nude dancing and eventually alcohol sales at the city's strip clubs. Now, as it turns out, there's no fun running a strip club if your strippers can't take off their clothes. And that point was made very clearly by Frank Muscogee III, who represents a couple of these clubs. He said this, no one is going to go to a strip club to buy an overpriced soda and watch a woman dance in, I'm not going to repeat the word, but clothing that is short of stripping. Then he said, they're going to run all of these businesses out of town. He said, they're going to run the strip clubs out of business. We've been talking a lot on this edition about human sinfulness, and this last story is a graphic reminder that the logic of sin can get so ingrained in a community and in a society that it can make sense to those who run these businesses to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and demand the right to have, well, nudity in their business because, after all, otherwise their business will go out of existence, as if it is simply on its face the fact that every business ought to survive. In a fallen world, many businesses will be nefarious businesses. I mean, after all, this kind of argument can be made by organized crime. If you enforce the law, you'll put our business out of business. One of the lamentable factors of human life is that there is a market for such things. And in just about every town, if adequate laws are not in place, there will be those who will try to commercially meet that demand. Any sane or civilized society draws lines. It does legislate morality. There's very little else interesting to legislate. All legislation is either procedural or, in its core, moral. These strip club owners are trying to go to the Supreme Court to protect what they claim are their rights, but they're also trying to embarrass the city for having such a law. It amazes me that a man can make an argument like this with a straight face on the front page and think that the readers of the paper are going to go, you know, he's right. We need to repeal these laws to save their business. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. I want to remind you about a very significant conference coming up on the Southern Seminary campus. It's for high school students, and the name of the conference is important. Why? Because it is. It's going to be held March 18 through 19 of 2011. Featured speakers are myself, along with Dr. Russell Moore, and special guest Dr. J.D. Greer of the Summit Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm really looking forward to having all these high school students here. They bring so much energy, and I think we're going to deliver to them some very important messages they need to hear in order to develop a Christian worldview and to focus on what is truly most important. You'll find information about the important conference and many other events at Southern Seminary by going to the website at sbts.edu. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.